You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Now I just want to dike out about pathological liars because...
Are there more of them in the dyke community? Because I have met two.
The fact that we lit up when you said pathological liar and had examples ready, yeah.
I'm diking out, you're diking out. Let's dike out together, see what it's all about.
Diking out!
Hi, and welcome to Diking Out, a podcast that is gatekeeping Drake from the lesbian community. You're welcome. I'm Carolyn Bergier.
I'm Melody Kamali, and today we're diking out with writer Zoe Whittle about the queer lit community. And I'm just going to go ahead and say we can gatekeep Drake from that, too.
Okay, he doesn't belong.
No. Scram.
Couple of announcements. We are still hosting these L Word watch parties at Henrietta Hudson's every Friday. So do check those out. Come see us there. We're having the time of our lives. Also,
if you could please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, 5 stars if you're nasty. A little blurb of a review goes a long way and really helps people find us. And we're just trying to collect queers for our advancement of the gay agenda. Help us out. Join the army.
Yes. And, you know, we've taken some big strides in terms of advancing the agenda for our community. I would say that our Rosie episode got a lot of straights into the fold. We had a lot of straight people listening.
Oh, yeah.
If you came back for another episode, if you want us to even think of considering you as an ally, you better rate us 5 stars and review. We also want to thank everybody for all of your kind words. We had a lot of people saying that they were crying tears of joy for us while listening to the Rosie Ep. It means a lot. We felt the love. We felt the support, especially for everyone who was there from the start and knows everything that went into this wild, wild journey to get to our convo with Ro, our new BFF.
It happened. Where do we go from here? I'm excited to find out.
Isn't it crazy that now I'm in a throuple with Rosie O'Donnell?
Yeah, on record. From on Rosie record. O'Donnell. Oh, I'm sorry, Ro. Guys,
Ro.
We're on that kind of term.
But back to normal business. Melody, what's the gayest thing you did this week?
Hands down has to be getting a over 2 hour astrology and tarot session a few days ago. I think nothing is queerer than astrology lately.
Obviously.
And I've always, you know, we hear us joking about being Capricorns, but like, I don't actually know that much. And what I do know is like probably false because it's all from meme pages. And actually, I talked to this astrologer about how much they hate meme pages. And actually, I was at the beach the next day with David Odyssey. He's a journalist, performer. He is also an astrologer for Nylon Magazine. And he said the same thing. He says he actually mutes people on Instagram who post anything from these meme pages. He says they're false. There's so much more nuance to it. And I learned that in my session. I booked this with, her name is Kristen Rand. You can find her on Instagram at Good Witch Mama. She has the best energy out of anyone I've ever met. I originally met her years back at a comedy festival. She is so good at tarot. She really tells a story with it. Everything she told me about my chart and things I like might not connect with when it comes to Capricorn, she was telling me all this before I could even tell her. You know, she would just like read my chart, speak for 10 minutes and kind of stop and be like, how does that resonate? And I'd be like, 100% perfectly. Like, it was eerie. And I learned about like the houses. I'm a 12th house Capricorn sun, and I've never connected with the workhorse, like social climby stuff with the Capricorn stereotype. And I learned it's because of the house I was born. It was when the sun was in the 12th house. 12th house is very spacey, mystical. Actually, David Odyssey was like, it makes so much sense that you're a podcaster. This 12th house Capricorn sun, by the way, David Bowie and Aaliyah were both 12th house Capricorn suns, not to brag. And was like, it's very voice of a generation. It's very, you're speaking for your generation and also...
Eat it, Lena Dunham.
Yeah, I know. That's the first thing I thought, too. And it's so funny because Kristen said these same words, too, and was like, you're... making a lasting impact that like extends past like into like legacy. And so she was like, it makes sense that you're like podcasting.
Yes.
And they also said it makes sense that you edit, maybe over edit. I'm like, I'm literally a video editor. Yeah. like a lot of it, I don't know, was spot on. And I highly recommend getting like a more thorough chart reading if you're interested in this, if you're curious about this, and sort of disregarding all the meme pages. I know they can be fun, but I think that's like sort of what they're for, just fun and not to be taken so seriously. They really right. made me like hate everything about my chart because it is a Capricorn stellium. So much of my placements are in Capricorn, but like when you look at the chart and the houses, like, I don't know. I would always look for different placements that weren't Capricorn. So I'd be like, ooh, I have an Aries Mars. I'm going to run with that and like look into what that meant.
Yeah.
So it made me love being a Capricorn again. And astrology is gay. What do you want? What do you want from me? Carolyn.
Yes.
My fellow Capricorn, what is the gayest thing you did this week?
Well, my nephews came to visit and we went to Legoland. And some of you know, my wife, Cecilia, is a big fan of Legos. So we have an extensive Lego collection. Cecilia had already been to Legoland when her sister came to visit. And her sister bought her the Pride limited edition Lego set. So it is basically the...
Wow.
The progress rainbow, which includes like the black, brown, and then the trans colors in it. It's like a kind of L shape build. And then there's a corresponding minifigure that matches each of the colors standing on it. So my cousins came and Cecilia brought some of her Legos out for them.
Okay, I've looked it up.
Yes. So gay, right?
So gay.
So
everything, everyone is awesome.
Right.
Lego, everyone is awesome.
Yes. And my one nephew has been really into rainbows and all of his drawings, everything. He likes the order of the colors and he's always drawing rainbows. So he loved the set. My younger one, he likes to mix things up. So then they were kind of like fighting because one kept trying to mix up the colors and then the other one likes the order. So when we went to Legoland with them, we got them each their own Pride set and they were so happy. And when they got back to Buffalo, they built them and then FaceTimed me to show Cecilia and I their gay Lego sets. It was so cute.
That's so cute.
Very gay.
That's so gay.
Just building the gay Lego sets.
Gifted from gay aunts. It's all so homosexual.
It is. And on that note, I think we should get into our very homo
heavy
interview for this week, per usual. We do have a special note, though. Speaking of homos, there is a White Lotus spoiler for all of you queers that are watching White Lotus and maybe haven't finished yet. When you hear Zoe bring up White Lotus, maybe skip ahead a minute.
Yeah.
So that you miss that spoiler. So today we are diking out with poet, novelist, and TV writer Zoe Whittle about the queer writing community, or the queer lit community, however you want to call it. She's in it. She's the author of three previous novels, including the Lambda-winning Holding Still for as Long as Possible and her well-known debut, Bottle Rocket Hearts. She's written collections of poetry. She's also a Canadian Screen Award-winning TV and film writer with credits on one of our favorites, Baroness Von Sketch Show, Schitt's Creek, and Degrassi, heard of it? Drake? her latest novel, The Spectacular, is out. Let's go. Zoe, thank you so much for being here and diking out with us today. How are you?
I am so psyched to be here.
Yes, it's a big day.
Yeah, it's a big day. This is the Canadian Pub Day, and it's coming up on September 14th in America. So I'm pretty psyched about that.
Yes. And the pub date of what exactly? Tell our listeners what book they'll be buying soon.
So the book is called The Spectacular. It's a novel. And there's a lot of queerness in it, like all my novels.
Yes. So, yeah. Yes. I have to say, this is the first book of yours that I've read, but I now need to read more. You are such a phenomenal writer.
Thank you.
I felt like I was reading like memoirs of different people. Like, these characters feel right. So real, and the writing is so on point, and the stories you tell and the themes and the topics you cover. Do you want to tell everybody what it's about? But it's just so good, and I just have to say, read it for yourself, but Zoe, give your pitch.
Sure. It's kind of a hard book to give an elevator pitch for, but so right. far, because there are three narrators, three different time periods, but basically it's a book about sex and autonomy and reproductive freedoms and motherhood. And it sort of came to be because I spent the last 15 years now, almost, well, really about a decade, every day waking up and being like, should I have a kid? And my ex-wife didn't want to have kids. And we were together for most of my 30s, and it was a big thing. And then my boyfriend after that already had kids, and it was never the right time. I never had enough money. And so every day I was like, should I or shouldn't I? Should I or shouldn't I? And then so through the characters in this book, I sort of gave them all different moments in their lives where they were debating it, trying to avoid it at all costs, really wanting it, like all the kind of different emotional realities of making that decision, especially since like queer people, there's so much has to go into that decision. You can't just fuck up and have a glass of wine one night and make it happen.
Right.
So that's sort of what it's about. And it's in some parts, it's a love story between, in the latter half of the book, it's a love story between a femme and a trans man, kind of a doomed, mismatched attachment style love affair.
Love it. Yeah. And what you just said about being queer and getting pregnant, I was just talking to somebody else and we were like, it really is unfortunate that it doesn't happen accidentally for us, and that you really have to be so intentional about it. It's probably better for the kid that it has to be so intentional.
Sure.
But at the same time, it never feels like a good time. It always feels like, well, like, let's wait a little bit more, wait until this happens or that. And the planning of it can just derail you to until you're at a point where it's too late.
That's exactly what happened to me. I used to have a joke in my stand-up set that was like, I'm not going to do the joke right, but basically I procrastinated for 10 years and now I just don't have a kid.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. As a procrastinator, I think that would like put me off even longer on that project. It's just, feels like work.
And it is work. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's so much work. It's work. It's money. But it's a great book, and the way it unfolds, and like real pleasure reading.
Thank you.
I brought it along with me to Provincetown last week, and it was a great beach read, I will say.
Gay beach read, yes.
Yes.
Well, Zoe, we hope you're having a great week so far. We'd like to know, what is the gayest thing you've done in the last week?
The last week? Well, like this morning I rode my bike wearing really old Birkenstocks and no bra to the coffee shop. That's pretty gay.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the first thing off the top of my head.
Wow. Thoroughly gay.
Yeah.
And like larger context of gay things going on in your life, you are moving outside of Toronto, and tell us a little bit about the area that you're moving to.
So I'm moving to a town called Picton, and it's in a county called Prince Edward County. And so many, I don't know if this is happening in the States, but so many people are leaving the city. And there's
yes,
so many,
I did that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so many queer people going to this particular area that we've started calling it Prince Edward County.
We gotta go.
I know. It's on the list now. We have to come.
And a lot of writers out there too, a lot of artists.
I wish we had been more thoughtful when we picked where we were moving and picked the lesbian outpost, I guess, of New York City. Are there any? Where could we
move? Beacon, New York.
Beacon, I guess, would have been. Yeah, Beacon is very, very gay, but a little further out than I wanted. But that sounds great. And how rural is it? I mean, you grew up in a rural environment, correct?
Yes. I grew up on a farm in the Eastern Townships in Quebec.
Yeah.
And so Picton is a town. It's bigger than any small town I've lived in, but it's still quite, you know, it's a real tourist hub, so it's kind of hard to quantify. But it's very small compared to Toronto.
And how far is it just outside of Toronto? My family lives in Buffalo, so I'm actually like calculating in my head, like, is this a day trip? Like,
I think it probably would be a day trip from Buffalo. Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well,
geographically challenged, but.
Did the border reopen yet? Am I?
We got to get to Prince Leswerth. You can't just drop that
I know.
Name on Dyking Out. We're there. We're making a pilgrimage.
So you're an author. You do stand up. You're a screenwriter. Tell our listeners a little bit about your background that I'm very envious of.
So I started as a poet, and it was the 90s. So I had like a bad Ani DiFranco musician stage for a couple years. And then I realized I'm not a good singer. And then after that, I moved into fiction, and I published my first novel in 2007. And it's called Bottle Rocket Hearts. And it's actually like a coming out story about a young femme in Montreal around the 1995 referendum. And it's about her falling in love with an older woman who is a bit of a con artist. It's a bit of a like torturous first dyke love affair story.
I love it. Oh,
and then
my
second novel is called Holding Still for As Long as Possible, and trying to turn it into a TV show right now. And that is a love triangle between a trans guy and two queer women. And it's a lot about different types of anxiety disorders. And then the next book was The Best Kind of People. And I'll get into this later when we talk about like the realities of being a queer writer and writing queer content. But this book took a bit of a turn, and it was more of a traditional like family novel, social novel. It was kind of about the family of a guy who's a teacher who's accused of sexual assault where he teaches. And it's from the point of view of the people around him and how they react and their kind of emotional realities in the wake of those accusations. And then now this is The Spectacular, which I'm calling like my sex and abortion and babies book. it's hard to summarize. And I also, before Best Kind of People came out, I started writing TV. And I got into TV because I started taking stand-up comedy classes while I was writing The Best Kind of People, because it was such a serious book and I needed an outlet. And I always had this.
I love that.
Yeah. I always had this fantasy of trying stand-up comedy. And I've been an obsessive fan since I was a teenager. And like, I used to have Janine Garofalo sets memorized and stuff.
Yes.
And so I just thought I'd try it out, and it turned out to be really fun. And I'm not a professional by any stretch, but it did lead me into the world of comedy writing. And I started out on the show Degrassi, which lots of gay content there.
Yes, really, yes, definitely.
Heard of it.
Yeah. Really, and like really warm, amazing group of people that I met there. it was like the perfect way to start a kind of side career. And I've just been sort of chipping away at it ever since.
Baroness von Sketch.
I know, like, is she going to say it? One of my favorite shows.
Right.
So good.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say it. Sometimes Americans don't know it, but I'm like, it is incredible. It's like,
I don't know
so
why they should don't know. Yeah. Everyone watch Baroness von Sketch show. Yeah. It is
it's so gay.
It's so gay. Yeah. And I wanted to know just like what that writer's room, how gay it actually is, because they just feel so queer even when they're not explicitly.
Right. The room was really, really diverse in terms of who was in it. But it was all mostly women and like pretty big, probably like 10, 15 people in the room at a time, which I guess is small by American standards, but it felt big. So it was always like the actors who also produced the show and then a couple of staff writers. And then they do this thing, which I think was based on how the kids in the hall used to do it, where they had writers come in for 2-3 weeks at a time and just sort of cycle through. And so I was one of those writers that kind of came in for 3-4 weeks at a time. And we had a lot of amazing queer writers on that show, like Carolyn Taylor, who's in the cast.
Yeah.
She's so incredible. Funny. And then Mae Martin, who was Mae Martin from Feel Good, and Sabrina Jalees, who's been in everything.
And
Elvira Kurt, who's awesome. Just lots of like really A-list like comedians who kind of went through, and so many others too. Like just like the when you look at the writers on that show, there's so much talent. And I was really kind of really new to sketch comedy, and so people were very gentle with me though, and like it was kind of great to be an outsider because I didn't really know all the like dynamics of that community, and it was fun. But it was a really, actually out of all the comedy rooms I've been in, it was the kindest and the most fun.
Great to hear.
Yeah. I know. That sounds like a paradise.
Yeah.
Well, with that, let's get into our topic about the queer writing community. So you mentioned you've done poetry, screenwriting, novelists. Do you have a favorite, or do you like mixing it up?
You know, I've recently started to really love short stories, and I have a new collection coming out in 2023 called Wild Failure. And I used to be very flummoxed by the form, and now I think I really find the constraint of it all quite fulfilling. And so I think that's my favorite right now. But I also just love writing half hour comedies. You know, they're fun. They're fun. Like, you know, it's a different kind of an attachment that I can have to TV, because TV always changes. And also, like, you put all your heart and soul into one 30-page script, and then network executives are like, no, we don't want it. And then you have to move on really quick. So you have to have like less attachment.
Right.
And also anything that gets to screen is going to be written by 15 people. And so it's like, it's different with books, where it's your own and it's precious and you have control over it. I kind of am really lucky in that I started going into television because I wanted to make a living, and I ended up loving it just as much as fiction, which was like a real blessing.
Since you started your career in writing, how has the queer lit scene evolved? I imagine it's been very different in terms of both reception from publishers, but also the community of writers themselves.
Yes, it's really changed since I put my last book out in 2016, like just incredibly different. But especially since 2007, when my first novel came out, I really feel like back then you could only get ahead as a queer writer who wrote queer content and wasn't closeted if there was like an underground queer, like kind of secret world where people helped each other out. Like, I got my first funding grant because there happened to be a lesbian on the jury. I was introduced to my agent through a lesbian writer I know. I got my first, you know, everybody said no to my first book, but there was a gay editor who saw promise in it. Like, all of these things kind of worked out like that. And I was actually listening to Matilda Sycamore this morning on a Tin House podcast, and she was talking about how many rejections she would get that all said the same thing, where they were like, we really like your voice, we really love what you're doing, but we don't know how to market you. And that was kind of the phrase that a lot of queer writers would get, because it wasn't a sound investment, right? Especially with corporate publishers. And so, like, even with my second novel, and like, someone from a really big corporate publisher in the States, an editor, sent me a private note to say that she loved the book and that she had a trans boyfriend, and wanted, you know, really wanted to publish it. But they just marketing would say no, and that we don't know how to reach the audience. And I think that this is just the way it was. And there was a sense that like any kind of any kind of critic or like critical reviews inside the literary establishment would be like really hard to imagine. And so, but if you think about the last like 5-6 years, there are major queer writers now who get reviewed in the Paris Review and in the New York Times. Like it's no longer strange. Like, and we used to, I think when I first came out, there was this niche of queer writer. There'd be like a shelf at the major bookstores that was for the LGBT section. And there was like,
right.
we used to have a gay bookstore in Montreal. Like there was its own world, but it would just kind of operated within its own, like it had its own system. Like I remember with my second book, I said, oh, I know Eileen Miles and I could ask Sarah Schulman for a quote. Like when we were talking to my publisher about who we could ask for endorsements. And they were like, we don't know who those people are. And to me, they're celebrities, you know, and
right.
I'd like network to try to meet them and stuff. And now everybody knows who they are in the mainstream literary world. Those are just two names by, you know, example, but there's a language and there's a, you know, a milieu that we've all been working in. And our books have been having conversations with each other for years. And now the straight world is paying attention. And I think in terms of corporate publishing, it's partly because we can now make money because that's yeah. like the objective of most publishers. And I think a lot of queer writers have really thrived in the small press scene. And we owe a lot to that world.
Do you think that it's more of the fact that people are more like vocally out now so they can find the audiences, but they still don't think that straight people want to read queer content? Like I just feel like a lot of queer content is still seen as like, oh, this is just for
queer others.
People. Mm-hmm. Let's say a podcast called Dyking Out that a straight person would think like, no way.
Not for me. Yeah.
They can learn something.
Just never say the name.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I need to tell you something about that in 1 second, but it reminds me so much of an Amazon review I got for my first book that was just, it was so simple. It was like 2 sentences. It said like, I didn't know this was a gay book. I wouldn't have picked it up if I knew, but I ended up really liking it relating to the characters. And I was like, this is the problem. Like there's a real issue with how we're taught to read and taught to, you know, no one would ever be like, this story's about a murderer and I'm not a murderer. I'm not going to read it. You know,
exactly.
Like, the limits
exactly.
of empathy. Yeah.
I don't understand it. And also just all the straight content. Like we all watched Friends.
Exactly.
There was nothing for us in that show.
We've been having
despite how many lesbians love Jennifer Aniston. Okay. I don't get it.
Totally.
There's nothing for us in that show.
Nothing. And exactly. Like queer people have had to insert ourselves into straight and cis narratives forever. We know how to do it. It's like really not that big a deal to like ask straight and cis people to do that now. In
right.
the same way, to like to have that same imagination and ability to empathize. Yeah. But anyway, it's so funny. I was so glad to get your invitation to the podcast because I had this strange experience of having a sensitivity read done on my book, which I've never had before.
Oh.
I have, and I feel weird about it. I have, I have myself, like when a couple of my books have trans characters. And so when I do, I have like a bunch of friends and an ex who will read the manuscript at certain points and just to be like, this is right, this isn't right, you know, that kind of stuff, just sort of to do due diligence. And so when they did the sensitivity read, I wasn't really sure what they were trying to do. But then the reader, I think, felt like they were like, I don't know, maybe 5 years old, like maybe out for a day. And they were like, you know, the word dyke is considered offensive by some. And I was like,
you know,
and I was like, Jesus Christ. Yeah, it was so, I had to like put my email down and walk away because I was so angry and just like it just, I just felt like, how dare somebody who's probably like young enough to have watched Glee with their parents,
right.
you know, say that to someone who's had like beer cans thrown at their head for kissing a girl on the street, you know, or had, you know, I've had the word
right.
dyke hurled at me like many, many times in near violent situations. And like, how dare this person say that? Like, it was just, it felt like a failure on older queer people's part to educate the younger folks.
Yes, and you've perfectly described the type that seems to be most lectury about...
Five-year-olds.
About that, though, we had Natasha Negovanlis on the podcast, and she was even saying that she wasn't sure if she should be on the podcast because of the name of it.
Wow.
Just knowing how sensitive her fans are and saying that that's not a word that resonates with her. And we're like, not everybody on the podcast identifies as a dyke. We just do. So, but that's fine if you don't. And in her just saying the name of the podcast in the context of, I'm not comfortable identifying with this, somebody attacked her on Twitter for it. It was just so crazy, and like she had to pull up receipts. It was nuts.
But granted, every Twitter profile we pulled up that was criticizing her for even saying that she was on the podcast and putting it in that context,
yeah,
did have 17 in their bio, like 17, right. 16, yeah. 18.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's just very interesting to be so self-aware that they're out at such a young age, right? They're coming out when they're 13, 14, but then also yelling at their elders for self-identifying as dykes.
Yeah.
It's crazy to me.
Well, I guess speaking of sensitivity and criticism, how has that changed over the years?
Well, it's interesting. Like, I have made mistakes in my work before. Like, I think about my very first novel that came out.
What are you, human? Come on.
Like, in particular, I used the R word in my first novel. And, like, it was just part of that early aughts ironic humor that people were being offensive to be offensive. Like, you know, terrible time.
Yeah.
Really dumb. Really don't feel great about it. And so, like, you know, I wrote an apology on Goodreads for that. I do feel bad.
No one ever does that, even though, like, I don't know.
I feel like I didn't really have, even though I kind of somewhat identify as a disabled person, I feel like I had no consciousness around ableism back then. And like, it's like a thing that I've really been reading about and thinking about for the last 5-10 years. And so it did feel like, yeah, Oh, this is significant. And if it's ever reprinted, I would like to, you know, edit that out. But I think in terms of sensitivity, like, I think it's really great that publishers and artists are like thinking about their positionality. And, you know, that as a white person, I'm a white artist in a kind of business that's rigged in my favor. Like, there are lots of ways to just be rethinking the art that we're making, and like,
for sure,
whether or not, like, you know, just the positions I'm taking or that my characters are taking. And that's like, this is all good learning to do, but there are generational issues. Like, there are like a lot of really weird ways that I think young people are learning to read right now, and like not really understanding what the role of fiction and what fiction is. Like, a lot of feedback around, like, a lot of reviewers and talk on social media around whether a book is good or not has to do with whether or not the characters are good people or like relatable.
Right.
And I think this might be a bit about YA and like how it's marketed. I don't really read YA.
Seen it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of YA drama online, yeah, and a lot of it is having these characters who maybe aren't
perfect.
Oh, well, definitely not perfect, or some might be like outright racist,
right,
and then being like, oh, there's a racist character in this book, so that must mean that the author is racist,
yeah,
and this book is bad, rather than having that be part of the story, because racism is part of life and has been like a theme in literature since, you know, forever. And then, you know, you have sites like Goodreads, and then that can like tank a book and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a lot. And, you know, I've been following you on Twitter for a while. Do you get into like the lit Twitter drama? Because that seems like a lot of times I'll just see like subtweets about lit twit drama, yeah, and I'm like, what is
Tell
happening?
This feels
always the discourse.
I don't. Yes. I try to stay away from Twitter in general.
Oh, you're so healthy.
Intense.
What's going on?
Yeah,
there?
It's
yeah,
terrible. I mean, it's great. It's a great way to waste time, and like, it is a good good place sometimes to like have interesting conversations and meet people. But yeah, the main character syndrome, like, or the main character thing about, you know, you say one thing and then people jump on you. Like, for me, it's a bit of like, if you're going to play, you're going to kind of have to accept that that could happen to you. If you're going to like put out content, sure, and you're going to offer your perspective, like people are, you're part of being a writer and an artist and having a public facing career is being able to take criticism. But it's hard. It's like emotionally hard. And I feel like part of what's hard for me sometimes is to just remember that Twitter is only a small part of the world and it can seem like the whole world. But I have friends who are never on Twitter. They don't give a shit. They don't know what's going on in the day, and their lives are much better for it. And yeah, it's like good to remember that it's just a small part of the world. I feel like in general, to go back to the like Goodreads situation, I feel like there is a fundamental misunderstanding about how stories are created and why. And when people criticize like TV shows or books for having, you know, bad characters or whatever, or for characters who make mistakes or are evil or weird or whatever, like you can't have a story without conflict. Like it just doesn't exist. Like what if you had two people who were just sitting around being didactic politically and like patting each other on the back? That's not a story. It's not an interesting story. But I do think that this conversation has kind of evolved from very real important conversations around representation and the whiteness and the straightness and cisness of the publishing industry and who's in a writing room, who's on TV. All those conversations are like really crucial and really great and have led to some really amazing changes sometimes. But I think this is like kind of the weird natural evolution of that, is that it sometimes ends up in these bananas takes, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems, and again, I'm like very outside the industry, but like you were saying with, you know, a greater sense of like awareness from the writers and the publishers and trying to be a lot more thoughtful about these issues and the realities of privilege and whatnot is one thing. And that's been a very positive thing, and for any artist to challenge ourselves to really think about the impact of our work. Right. Mm-hmm. And then it seems, though, from an audience perspective, there's almost like this overcorrection of them waiting to like hit the gotcha button or something. Yeah,
totally. Yeah. And I feel like to a certain extent, I try not to go on Goodreads. I feel like it's not a place for writers. I feel like it's a place for readers and to try to respect that. But like, you know, it's not a neutral place the way it was supposed to be when it was created. You know, it was created right before Twitter and it was a good place for people to like be like, to be in a book club kind of situation. And now it's owned by Amazon and it's not neutral. Yeah. And publishers invest a ton of money in sending out advanced copies of your book to like people who post a lot. And that can really backfire because, you know, if they send to, like, I had an experience of my last book kind of having a bit of a mystery element. Like it was sent to a lot of people who, when you looked at what their favorite books were, and then you looked at the bad review of my book, I was like, oh, this makes sense. Like, cause the book was, you know, it was a literary fiction book and you can't send a literary fiction book to people who mostly like paperback mysteries because they'll write things like, this is really boring. There's just so much about the character. Like, because it's not a, it's not a thriller. It's like, that's the form. It's a formal shift and difference. So, so it can backfire for sure. And then also people get mean and petty and like,
I wondered about that, how those get distributed. I have a friend who just seemed to be going through a crisis and just like, I don't like to take pictures of her book, started like hashtagging Bookstagram, like made her own like account. And it was like so much. And she wanted to get these arcs, but the only way she could was to build her like aesthetic on Instagram for like, so it was just, it seems like so much is just taken away from the actual book. What she gets sent doesn't make sense sometimes for like she likes to read. Yeah. But like, as long as it looks good on a pretty stack on this like stylized grid. Oh man, it like, yeah, it's very intriguing.
It's weird.
This world,
it's such a strange world. I keep thinking, you know, we used to have literary critics who could make a living and were serious and it's an art form in itself, and now you just, that just doesn't happen. So
sad.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you, but we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
Is there physical community? Like, I know writers, the stereotype a lot of the time are like shut-ins, like to stay at home. Are there physical like meetups? Because at the same time, when you talk about a queer writing community, queer people tend to need community, crave community, and seek it out. What's that like?
So it's really changed over the years since I began my career. I feel like when I first started publishing, there were about 10 queer authors in Canada, and we would all be able to fit at a dinner table, you know, and we all kind of helped each other out behind the scenes. And now there's a lot, there's just so many more writers, and it's awesome. And I think that it, you know, pre-COVID, it still felt really important to me to, like, we have a bookstore here called Glad Day Books, and they do amazing literary events, and like going out and being a part of that was really important to me. You know, I think as I get older, I'm more like of an indoorsy person and less of a bar person, but to me, the community is a big part of it. And also just sort of like, you know, helping to promote each other's work when they come out and being a cheerleader and that kind of thing.
Love it.
Is there a lot of drama, I guess, like offline, like between authors? Is there a lot of like, did you hear that this happened or this person's getting published or...
You know, I used to be a reporter for a couple of years at what is essentially the Publishers Weekly of Canada called Quill and Quire. And like the gossip in that office was pretty intense and all the time. And it was very funny. And it was usually about like how big someone's advance was, what somebody said at, you know, somebody got too drunk at the awards ceremony, or like, you know, dirt, who's dating who secretly, whatever. Like, I think that like, though nerdy, writers can get, you know, as petty as anyone. I guess it's funny because usually like my book launched today in Canada, and usually what happens in a publicity cycle is like, we have a lot of amazing literary festivals here. So often I would, you know, be flying somewhere new every week for a couple of months. And now it's like, I only have one festival that I'm going to go to in person. And so it's very different, but there's usually this kind of feeling that you have it's like you're in a graduating class or something. And it's like, whoever your cohort is that publicity season, you're going to see them in green rooms. You're going to see them at parties. And like, you end up feeling like you guys did a job together for a couple months. And so it's different. It's different with COVID.
Yeah,
it is. So, and I really thought that it would be done by now and that I would have a regular kind of go of it. But yeah.
Do you have, I feel like I'm digging for dirt, but I'm really not. But I want to ask, like, what are some of your pet peeves in terms of queer lit?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I love that question. I think that there are certain genres I'm tired of or I'm not drawn to. And I don't think, like, I'm not bragging about it. I don't, like, think it's great that I don't really understand sci-fi or feel drawn to it. And I think it's great that there's an amazing community of queer sci-fi writers. I don't personally get much from it.
They gave us Scientology, so.
Right. But also I feel like it makes sense. It makes sense that queer, like, people who grow up feeling like outsiders are drawn to speculative universes. Like, it actually, you know,
right.
I think that's why so many gay people love Buffy and stuff. I think it's mostly like
well, because Buffy's also the best show ever on TV. But anyway.
Oh, there you go. There she is.
Yeah. Oh my God. Everybody in my life thinks so too. And I just have never, I've watched a season or two, but.
Yeah, same.
That's fine. It's fine. I really lean into it. I don't think it's the best show ever, but it's up there.
But mostly the writers that drive me nuts are straight and like super entitled and snotty and elitist and all that stuff. But
right.
Like, I don't really have a gay writer nemesis.
No, okay. Man.
Yeah. Sorry.
We think of things a lot in terms of the comedy scene because Melody and I both do stand up.
Oh, awesome.
So it's like in terms of the drama and everything, I'm so much more in tune with what all the queer people are doing because that's who I care about and who I'm interested in.
Exactly.
And I'm sure that the straight people are being like a billion times worse or whatever, but I can't even tell them apart half the time. You know,
oh my God,
it's
yeah.
just like a blur of beards and.
Yes. And bad jokes. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
Did you guys love Douglas? The Hannah Gadsby second special.
You know, I couldn't even get through it.
I didn't finish it. I'm so sorry.
No, I got maybe
I
like
neither.
Okay.
I got like 5 minutes in and I turned it off and I saw like Nanette in person brag. I know I can't say it enough, but I did see Nanette in person and I loved it and I thought it was brilliant. And then I started watching Douglas and I'm like, pass.
I feel good about this conversation because I feel like secretly a lot of comedians are like, a lot of them didn't respond to Nanette and especially not to Douglas. And I find it really curious because like people who have studied the form and then, I don't know, I find it interesting. I was really taken by Nanette because I happened to turn it on and not know what it was. And I think I was like really surprised and that surprise was part of it. And then when I rewatched it, I was like, oh, I can see the cracks. It's different when you've sat through a lot of like feminist talks and performance art and stuff like that. Like there were things that I think a lot of critics thought were very new that didn't feel new about mm-hmm. it, you know?
Yeah.
But it was also very funny in part. So yeah, anyway, I'm just always curious when I'm talking to comedians, what they think.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I wish Hannah Gadsby all the best.
Of course,
yeah, there was just sometimes for me with comedy specials, sometimes I'll just turn it on and within 5 minutes, I can be like, I'm going to either have to try this again later. Like maybe I'm not in the mood for it.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's very different too than live comedy. Like totally. I bet if I saw Douglas live, I would have enjoyed it a lot more.
Yeah. It's hard for me. It's increasingly harder and harder for me to like sit and watch a special. It has to be like really absurd to get me to laugh. Yeah. Like, yeah, I wish the person I was going to say was queer or femme or anything. Like Rory Scovel, just a straight guy, but who like is very, inverts stand up is very absurd. And yeah, stuff like that.
I love
makes
Julio,
me laugh.
Julio Torres.
Oh, yes.
Torres.
I
yeah.
love him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Obsessed. Yeah.
Yes.
Aquarius. He's an Aquarius. What's your signs?
We're both Capricorns.
Oh, interesting. A double Capricorn podcast team.
Yes. Quadruple because we're both double Capricorns, both sun and rising with moons that are earthy.
Oh my God, amazing.
How about yourself?
Aquarius
and the rest.
I can't remember. I feel like my rising
it's okay
is
I used to not know it. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just at
I
this point
along.
Yeah until Melody came along and then I was asked so many times that I'm like, well, I guess I'm gonna have to look this up and remember it. Melody remembers it for me.
Oh. Yeah. She's a Taurus moon, guys.
Well, speaking of Capricorns and our Capricorn nature, we're both very curious about your process for writing. What are your routines? What are your rituals? Because you're very productive.
Thank you. It's like the only job. I recently discovered I have ADHD, and it makes everything in my life make sense because I can't really tell from the like very small. My apartment's always a mess, always has been. I just can't. Like, I'm so disorganized. I can barely keep track of anything, but I can focus on writing projects, which is part of, I think, the hyper-focus element of ADHD. And see, and I've lost my train of thought. I'm just like illustrating this for you. So my process is really like pre-COVID, I would often write at coffee shops with friends of mine who were also freelancing. So my friend Matt, who's a TV writer, we would often meet. My friend Allison, who writes novels, and another friend who does podcasting. Like, we would just kind of hang out and imitate what it was like to have an office, because we would be able to like arrive and do like chit chat and like see another human being and interact and like have all that to do and then focus. And it really helped me like feel like I had a real job, you know?
And I love that.
Yeah. So that was my process pre-COVID. And then occasionally I would have a couple of weeks here and there where I was in TV writing rooms. But like since COVID, I've just really been sitting with my cats every day, all day, kind of working. I often like will get up and go for a walk first and then do some house stuff and then focus. And I usually like, I used to be able to write at night when I was younger, and now I just, my brain shuts down at like 6 o'clock. It's like, finish the sentence, watch Gossip Girl, you know?
Oh, yes.
Do you journal? Are you a journaler?
Do we do morning pages?
I wish I still journaled. I think that there was something to it that I feel like Twitter has replaced journaling, which is awful to say. No, I mostly just, I start out with very messy, rough drafts. I'm writing a new novel right now, and I'm just sort of like, it's like doing a sprint where I'm sort of collecting things, and then I'll go back in the next draft and be like, oh, is she in a house? What does she look like? You know, do they really say this? Like, there'll be a ton of exposition that I have to like slow down and make into real scenes. But having having deadlines really helps. Like, having the pressure of failure helps, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. This was the first book that I wrote having an advanced book deal. Like, I sold it based on an idea, and I thought that that would make me write faster. It turns out it did not, but it did help me with some self-confidence, I guess. But yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. The deadlines definitely help. Like, I just formed a writing group with a few people, because without deadlines, I'm just nowhere. I'm not getting anything done in terms of writing. And even though like writing is probably the thing I love doing most, it's the thing that is like hardest to get myself to do. So I'm always so curious with other people and their process, like who, you know, get up and they don't do anything else until they've gotten like X many pages done. I'm like, but how? Like, are you just born that way?
To me, I'm chasing the high of having done it. Like that feeling at the end of the day where I didn't write anything. Like, it happens quite often, actually, like, especially because I'm so bad at email and like administration and stuff. Like, sometimes I'll just lose whole afternoons to like stupid emails. But the feeling of having been productive is such a high for me. And the feeling of not having written is such a fucking drag and kind of ruins my night. But just, yeah, I guess my own mental breakdown possibility is what keeps me going.
I wish that would for me. I just sit in those breakdowns. Ugh.
I hear ya. But I'm interested, like, whenever I've done comedy, and again, I'm not a professional, but I feel like writing my stand-up sets, I don't know how you guys do it. Like, and that feeling of, cause I'm such a writer, like I'm such a page-based person that I often get up on stage and I'll still have my notes, like a super nerd who hasn't done it before. Yeah. Like that kind of the ease of being able to just tell your jokes and that them being in your brain. And I really admire that, cause it's so
very
hard.
Janine Garofalo to bring your notes in the book.
Right.
When you said that you would like memorize your sets, I'm like, wow, that is quite the.
Has she?
That's like very. Yeah, I know. Like she doesn't even know her sets. No.
I know, but she's so genius.
She does. Yeah, no, yeah. She does. I've seen her enough at this point that what seems to be like this spontaneous happening, like there is a lot of method to the madness of Janine, and just one incredible person.
I just saw a photo of her on stage from a recent show, and her notebook was on stage, and I zoomed in, which was probably a breach privacy. But there was just like a few simple drawings on the page. So I'm like, maybe she just like, it's just a part of,
it's just her of the act.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, there was nothing really written.
Yeah.
Right.
But there was like a picture of her leaning down to like check the notebook. It was very interesting.
Oh my God. That's so funny.
I think one of the last times I saw her, it was like a rainy day. So she had all of her notes in like a Ziploc bag, like tucked into her, her fanny pack.
Oh my God, amazing.
And she's just like shaking the water off the Ziploc bag and then getting her notes. Anyway,
she's amazing.
Yeah. When you were mentioning gathering and researching for your planning, let's talk a little bit more going back to the spectacular or any book you've written, but how do you really get yourself into the character's mindset? How do you create such just dynamic, realistic characters? What's the process for getting there?
You know, it's different for every book. Sometimes I do, like when I my second book has a lot of paramedics in it. So I did a lot of interviews with paramedics. So sometimes I do that and there's sort of like character studies. And then sometimes I just take little bits of people I've met and sort of give them a different, like it kind of expand them, exaggerate them. I'm actually working on a book right now. This is very Dyking Out about, that's kind of loosely based on an ex-girlfriend of mine who lied to me about having cancer. She was a pathological liar. So I'm trying to write like a Dirty John type book where it's like what it feels like to be conned by someone. But it's narrated by two characters. One is like, I made her straight in the book. And we don't need any more crazy lesbian books, right? even though it would be cathartic. But like, so like there's a guy who's dating her and then there's a friend who meets her and they have these like really intense 3 or 4 months of getting to know her. And I don't know if you've ever dealt with like a pathological liar or a sociopath.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
I answered your Twitter post about it, but I only used one example because I've had many.
Oh, wow. We're like magnets. Oh my God. I think writers are actually quite, I think sometimes there's something about like the alchemy of, I think it's also because pathological liars are drawn to perceived power and like writers can be seen as interesting, even though they're not, you know, like, that's so interesting. Yeah. So anyway, I'm using like the feelings of the experience of having been conned to inform these characters and how they might react to someone like her. And it's interesting. It's been a real challenge because like, you know, the book so far is called The Fake and it's like going to be, the reader's going to know from day one that she's a con artist, but like, it's kind of watching how they figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, now I just want to dike out about pathological liars because.
Are there more of them in the dyke community? Because I have met two.
The fact that we lit up when you said pathological liar and had examples ready. Yeah.
Right? Actually, I'm not sure. There is one who I think might have been gay, but wasn't ready to be out with it or whatever, but did have a boyfriend in Canada, all believed, to be a lie. But this one in particular is actually a tricky one. I was going to ask you, have you ever suspected someone of being a pathological liar and have been wrong? Because I thought this person was also lying about having cancer. And I wasn't as close to them, but I had friends who were close to them. And when they would tell me these stories, I'm like, this does not make sense. Mm. And they were all suspicious too. So then years later, ran into some other mutuals from college and I'm like, hey, you knew this person, right? She was lying about having lymphoma, right? And they're like, she's dead.
Oh my God, of lymphoma?
I don't believe she died. No, I don't even believe she's dead. I don't even believe she's dead.
I love it.
But I could be wrong and I could be the biggest asshole, but I cannot find an obituary. But I also can't find any trace of them online. So I'm like, are they dead? Like, I've spent hours digging into this, but I'm like, yeah, I'm like, I don't know if I'm wrong. I don't know if this person's like alive or if they actually like faked their own death. But anyway.
That's incredible. So I have a confirmed lying about cancer. My roommate, gay man, but so not dyke specific, but had a ex-boyfriend who lied to him about having cancer and ended up stealing a lot of money from him, getting him to make a GoFundMe. Took a lot.
Yeah. Oh, and then another person who I thought was lying about cancer, and I was almost positive. And then years later, was like, wonder what happened to that person. Look them up on Facebook, and the picture was of them with no hair.
Oh.
I still think they're lying. Like, I still think, I'm so sure that they've taken it to this extreme where they got their head shaved just to like go with the narrative, because it wasn't even the cancer that they said when I knew them. It was like something else.
For cancer. Yeah. And I think that, like, you know, I was younger when I had this experience and I hadn't met anybody with cancer. And the one person in my life who'd had a mom die of cancer, when she met her, was like, she's a liar. Knew right away. And I was like, I don't know. I don't think so. And then later I was like, oh, that's because she knew. And then like, I had a good friend die of cancer 3 years ago. And the experience of watching her be sick, I was like, I can't believe I believed my ex, because it's so different.
Right. If you've known anybody with cancer, then you can sniff out the people lying about cancer.
Yeah, because they do. And they act very really differently. It feels totally crazy. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that book.
Yeah.
I hope so. I hope it works out. I don't know.
And eventual adaptation.
I think it could be really cinematic, actually. I feel like it would be a really good limited series.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's so crazy. Why do people do that?
I don't know. And I think like what drove me nuts was the question of like, are they just really mentally ill? Are they sociopathic? Like, is there a difference? What kind of, and there are so many different ways that you can be diagnosed when you're in that scenario. And it's just fascinating. But what occurs to me is like, now, whenever I meet somebody that I suspect is like pathologically similar, I know immediately. It's like a light shines down from the ceiling and I'm like, that person's too charming. That person's divulging too much right away. That person is like mirroring people to get them to like them. Like, you know, there's like real telltale things. And like, I listened to a podcast about a con artist recently, and the way that he manipulated people and the things he said, the phrases, the words he used, all the exact same as my ex. And so I feel like, oh, it's a real
what was
pattern.
That? I want to listen.
Oh, it's called,
that.
Oh my God, it's so good. It's called Do You Know Mordecai? And it's about like a bunch of women who got conned by the same man. Down. Yeah. It's really good.
Nice.
Yeah, I was excited when I started reading The Spectacular and I messaged Melody. I'm like, you're going to love this. There's cults.
Yeah, very interested in cults, cons.
Oh my God, me too.
And I'm such a mark. I get conned and manipulated and take advantage of all the time.
No.
No matter how much I think I'm fascinated and can like tell these signs.
Well, you're just a trusting person. Yeah.
Yeah.
Zoe, you did say something about, you know, we don't need another crazy lesbian story. So when you're writing, like, how much of that does weigh on you? Because, as much as, like, when we write characters that don't have much representation, we kind of want to write them in a good, positive light and not have, like, a shitty queer character. But as we know, there are a lot of shitty queer people, just as there are a lot of shitty not queer people. People are shitty. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are complicated because I think that you shouldn't, like, I think writers can write about anything. You shouldn't limit how a character develops based on, like, you know, the stereotypes that might, that have, like, have emerged through straight people writing about gay people, you know. But I still feel like, I think it might be my generation. Like, I would be uneasy writing a bisexual killer character, you know, or like, there's certain stereotypes that I think just, there aren't enough queer creators yet to have kind of even the playing field in some ways. So I'm still worried about it a little bit. And I probably don't need to be, but I think in this particular situation, I'm also trying to avoid, you know, the real person I'm sort of writing about. Like, I don't want to be sued or like, you know, I'm still like a tiny bit afraid of her. And so I want to fictionalize in that way. But, you know, it's funny because like somebody was criticizing The White Lotus. Have you seen The White Lotus?
Yes.
Loved it. And someone was saying like, oh, I hate that they killed the gay guy and that, you know, that was terrible or whatever. And I was like, I don't think it's really true that was terrible. I think it was seemed like a surprise and inevitable at the end.
Definitely inevitable. He was on a destructive path from the start. You kind of saw it come, whatever.
Totally. I think you can tell when characters are written thinly and then gotten out of the way. Like, you can tell when someone's killing the lesbian because they don't know how to write her, or they want the straight man to get the girl or whatever. Like, you can tell the cheesy, corny story choices from the, like, you know, the real juicy, real stories. But it's still, it's a really good question. I feel both that I shouldn't have to change a character for the sake of someone thinking it might be homophobic, but I also, as a queer reader and queer viewer, am tired of certain stories. So if I'm going to have, like, I mean, there are two queer characters in the book, so it's a bit different, but I feel like if there's only going to be one villain and she's queer, there's something about it that still makes me a bit uncomfortable. And maybe that's like a lack of sophistication on my part, but I just feel like it's just partly my age, maybe. I don't know.
No, I get that, because like the one of the good things about the L word, because every conversation will ultimately go back to the L word, is that finally you had a show that had so many queer women that you could have some of them be batshit crazy and it was okay. And absolutely. Then we wouldn't have gotten the gift of Jenny Schechter without that.
Totally.
You did it, Carolyn.
I did it. Every episode.
It in.
I love that.
There needs to be a drinking game with this podcast.
Oh my God. Can I just tell you that I loved that? I can't remember their names totally, but I love that Wifey punched Finley in the wedding episode. Are you caught up on
that? Oh, that Danny? Like,
Danny.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a good
I thought that was great. I feel like there's something about the L word, even for all its flaws, that you could just tell that it's like they don't really care about the straight audience, right? Like, they kind of don't give a shit. And I love that. And I think like there's such a surge of queer content now where they're kind of aware of like a Gen Z politically correct viewer. And like, but it was true that Danny would have punched Finley and that everybody would have been like, yeah. And they don't need to have like accountability processes about it or whatever. They don't have to like,
I didn't even consider that.
Right. Like, it just feels true. It felt like a true dyke moment. And it reminded me of, like, I remember when I was really young and I was just understanding what butch and femme was and what bar culture was like. And my friend pointed out this like really popular, slightly older femme in the bar. And she was like, that girl walked into the bar and punched, and like her girlfriend had slept with someone and she just walked into the bar one night and punched that girl in the face. And I was like, oh my God, that is so cool and weird. And like, I was so... It was just so funny. It was just the antithesis of like the kind of lesbianism I was learning about in women's studies class versus like the bar culture lesbianism. It was totally different. And like, it just felt like a moment that was also of its time, because like, so if that happened now in that same age group, in that same world, would there be like, would someone be canceled? Would like, you know, would there be conversations about domestic partnership abuse in the lesbian community, which are all the great things. And I think that there should be.
Oh yeah.
But I'm not being like a dick about it, but I just thought it, like, that moment on the L word really, really struck me because it felt real for a soap opera, and that's what the L word is. Right?
Yeah.
And it also feels kind of true to how the dyke world can be toxic and like can react in these kind of soap opera ways.
Yeah.
With the drama. And I just thought that was great.
Yeah, I think with the context of all the now, you know, used to be we just had the L word. Now we have so much more than the L word. So the L word, like, thank you for continuing to do the stuff that only the L word can do. We don't need you to be that, you know, golden standard of television. We need you to be this trashy lesbian
we'll never
show.
Be.
Yeah.
Love it. I just love it.
Well, Zoe, thank you so much for speaking with us today about this and about your career and everything. It's very interesting. I'm sure we have a lot of listeners who are writers or love literature. Lots of lit dykes listening to this podcast. And is there anything else that you want to say about being a queer writer or the Spectacular or...
Well, I just really hope that the Spectacular finds readers in the queer community. And because some of the marketing of the book doesn't really explicitly say that there's a femme character and a trans guy, and like that it's quite, there's quite a lot of diversity and like within the queer world. Because a lot of the publicity is about like how there are themes about motherhood, which is true. But I feel like sometimes, like even just as a reader, I would maybe be like, oh, this book is about motherhood. Maybe I'm not into it. You know, like it can be marketed as like women's fiction or whatever. And like, that's not what it is. Yeah. And so I'm really excited to be on this podcast and to do queer media because it's, to me, it's a real queer story.
Amazing.
Definitely.
Well, thank you for coming on. Where can people follow you on Twitter and elsewhere?
Twitter, I'm on Instagram, and I just have like 4 TikTok followers and all of the videos are of my cats.
Great. You're about to get 4,000 more. No.
Yeah.
And that's at Zoe.
Yeah. At Zoe Woodall for TikTok.
Yeah.
Yeah. For Twitter. Yeah. I don't know what my TikTok is. I think it's probably something with my name. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll link to it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been so great to meet you both.
All right. It is time for our listener question. Let's get right to it, Mel.
Let's go. It's very on brand, on theme for the times. It's back to school. So let's do it. I was wondering, how did y'all find other queer people in college? I go to a very quote unquote liberal college, but I can't seem to find 1, any lesbians, 2, people who are secure with their queer identity. We have a lot of girls who kiss girls at parties kind of queer girls. How do you find a queer group that allows you to be your best lesbian self?
You start your own.
Yes.
That's direct answer, because when I was in college, you know, I was in college around the time that Facebook was starting up, and that was how we started finding each other, because it used to, you would put like woman interested in women.
Oh my,
and,
do you remember that shit?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's how you'd find them.
And that's how you'd find it. And you could do a search, and they let you search for other women interested in women at your college. And then we would just start messaging each other. That is literally how it happened. And then a bunch of them started a group, and they called it Pink Taco Productions. And they would host these parties around campus, and they had a MySpace page, and do the version of that that's relevant to today. So start your own group. If you're out and you're secure in your queer identity, then it's you. You're the chosen one. Go forth and collect.
Yeah, you're the one who is aware enough to know that there needs to be a group. A lot of girls are just figuring out that they might be queer. They might not know yet. You could be the gateway queer for a lot of girls. I mean, that's great. There are girls who kiss girls at parties. That's probably, they maybe help them realize there's so much more to the queer experience. Like, I was not out when I went to college. I was clicking that hyperlink on Facebook for sure, and like becoming aware of the other lesbians and sort of staring at them in the halls of my dorm, but like not doing anything about it. And that's something I regret. And I should have done something about it. And that's why we think you just have to take action. There's so much more tech now,
so
and media
yeah.
for you to organize.
You can,
so we know you can. If Carolyn can do it on Facebook.com and MySpace, you could do
it. I wasn't part of it. I just was aware and attended and maybe made out with some of those ladies. But
that's what it's for.
But yeah, you can do it. If it doesn't exist, if you build it, they will come. And that's it. Simply put, go.
That's it, actually.
You can do it. We have faith in you. You can figure it out. If you have a question for us, you can send it to dykingout@gmail.com. If you're a patron, let us know. Patrons go to the top of the question pile. That's patreon.com/dykingout. We also put out extra episodes every single week where we are much more revealing about our personal lives. We're much
That's
less
the word.
Edited. We are talking about current events, all sorts of things, pop culture, lesbians, gossip, all of that is on our Patreon every week for as little as $5 a month. So head there. You can follow us on all social platforms at Dyking Out. You can follow me personally at TGI Carolyn.
You can follow me at Melody Kamali. See you there.
Make sure you check out The Spectacular. It really is a great read, especially relevant to things that are happening today.
Yes.
It's very queer. Check it
so
out.
Queer.
Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you next Tuesday.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.